This is an ABC podcast.
Working on a remote mine site is one of the most isolating jobs in the world. You're thousands of k's from home, stuck without family and friends for weeks on end, and you've got nobody to hang out with except your workmates. And an explosive report's found if you're a woman, you're likely being bullied and sexually harassed on a daily basis. G'day, it's Dave Marchese with you, and on Hack we're talking about a damning report commissioned by one of Australia's mining giants into its workplace culture. But first, some Canberra chaos.
Hack.
A horrible, horrible person.
What people say in text messages on Twitter, frankly, doesn't matter anything.
And quote, a complete psycho.
He's an extraordinary human being.
On Triple J.
Yeah, we're only halfway through the week, but it's already been a rough one for Scott Morrison. The PM gave a big speech at the National Press Club yesterday, but all the attention was on a spicy question from a journalist at the end, and now the Prime Minister's fighting to defend his character. James Elton is a political journalist with the ABC's 7:30, and he joins us from Parliament House. G'day, James.
G'day, how are you going?
Yeah, good. At the end of Scott Morrison's National Press Club address yesterday, Channel 10's political editor Peter Van Onselen got up and he asked the PM this.
I've been provided with a text message exchange between the former New South Wales Premier and a current Liberal Cabinet Minister. I've got them right here. In one, she describes you as, quote, a horrible, horrible person, going on to say she did not trust you and you're more concerned with politics than people. The minister is even more scathing, describing you as a fraud and, quote, a complete psycho. Does this exchange surprise you? And what do you think it tells us?
Oh, James, I'm sensing the awkwardness from here. How did the Prime Minister respond to that?
He certainly did look like he was surprised. He immediately responded by saying he didn't know who was being referred to, that he obviously didn't agree with the assessment that was made there, and he doesn't think that that description matches his record in office. He's been asked about it again a number of times today, and he said a few other things. He said he hasn't had a chance to talk to Gladys Berejiklian about it, someone he's previously said is a good mate of his. He said that he's confident that this other person in the text exchange in this conversation is not a current member of his cabinet, which does contradict what the journalist is reporting here. And he's also said that he's not really fussed about trying to find out who it was. He says it's just Canberra gossip and it's not really his problem. But we have had a procession of ministers lining up today to say, hey, it wasn't me.
I mean, you know, insults are nothing new in politics. Pretty unusual to come from the same side, though. It's pretty explosive. Have we heard anything from the former New South Wales Premier, Gladys Berejiklian?
Yeah, the former New South Wales Premier did release a statement pretty quickly yesterday, and she said she had no recollection of such messages, which people have noted is a pretty careful phrase. It's not an explicit denial. She's just saying she doesn't remember them. And then she went on to compliment the PM, say, you know, he's a great guy. He's the best person to lead the country for years to come. So Gladys has said, yeah, no recollection of those messages.
Yeah, wow. I'm guessing the PM probably wasn't stoked that the attention was taken away from this big speech that he made. So what else happened at the press club yesterday?
There were a few distractions. There was a question in there about how much a litre of milk costs, which got everyone excited. Members of the government have been out today explaining, well, it all depends on the kind of milk, you know, soy, almond, that's the free market for you. But more seriously, it is a tradition that dates back to John Howard, really, that the PM speaks at the press club around this time of the year and sets out the agenda for the year to come, especially important in an election year like this one. So the PM did come armed with a number of announcements to make. There were some cash payments in there for aged care workers, two payments of $400 for them, which is something designed in part to stop people leaving that industry when we really need them. But in terms of messaging, I think the other thing that was really interesting yesterday was the way the PM tried to respond to the really tough summer that the country has had with Omicron after we were told that we were going to have this amazing Christmas. And the PM said up top that he hadn't got everything right. He was asked if he wanted to apologise for how he'd handled anything, and he resisted that. He didn't say sorry. Instead, he listed what he's calling lessons that he's got from hindsight. He's saying, you know, we rose expectations too much about the great Christmas. We wouldn't have done that if we had our time again. We would have put the army in control of the vaccine rollout sooner if we had our time again. And he's trying to make this into a bit of a positive. You know, we made mistakes, we have experience, and that means we'll be better placed than the other guys to deal with whatever comes next.
Not really. I'm sorry. That wasn't really said.
No.
James, it's easy to forget that we're not even in an election campaign officially yet. It feels like both the leaders are in full swing. We had Anthony Albanese giving his address to the National Press Club last week. Do we know when the election might be?
We don't exactly know, but it will almost certainly be in May, one of the Saturdays in May. The plan at the moment is for there to be one more federal budget in March on the current schedule, which the government will probably use to try to, as a final opportunity, to sort of shift the conversation heading into the last stretch of the campaign. And it'll be interesting to see what the Treasurer does do in that final budget.
And how are things shaping up at this stage? Is the coalition in trouble?
I think you'd have to say the polls aren't where they would like them to be at this stage of the cycle. The news poll that came out this week was notable, not so much for the result for the political parties. That gap has widened. Labor is up 56-44, which is a sizable gap that would mean really bad things for the government in terms of seats lost if it panned out. But more importantly, in some ways, is the personal stuff. Albanese is only 2 points behind Morrison now on better prime minister. He's closed that gap quite a bit, and the PM's personal approval has slumped. So Albanese's at a net satisfaction score of 0, which doesn't sound great, but the prime minister's personal net satisfaction is on minus 19. So the personal advantage that Scott Morrison had over Bill Shorten last time does not appear to be as present this time, and that does seem to change the calculus for Labor heading into this election.
Interesting. There's so much going on. ABC journalist James Elton, thank you so much for breaking it down for us.
No worries.
Some text messages. Someone says, I have some text messages that Emma Watson is in love with me, but you don't need no evidence. Another person says, Gladys with her standard, I don't remember response, just like the ICAC.
Hack. The report is absolutely confronting. The stories in it are sickening.
On Triple J.
Rio Tinto is one of Australia's biggest mining companies. It's got tens of thousands of employees and almost 80% of them are men. But yesterday a report came out exposing what it's like to work at Rio Tinto if you're a woman. It found sexual harassment, racism and bullying are rampant, and more than 20 women have reported actual or attempted rape or sexual assault in the past 5 years. ABC reporter Rebecca Trigger's been covering the story and she's with us now from Perth. G'day, Rebecca.
G'day, Dave.
What are some of the biggest findings of this review?
The big headline figure that came out yesterday was that 21 women have reported being either raped or, you know, were subject to an attempted rape or sexual assault. But alongside that, we also saw reports of just really everyday sexism and discrimination against women. You know, some examples in the report were sort of women were afraid of telling management that they'd gotten pregnant. They couldn't get flexible work hours. In some cases, they couldn't even get gender-specific toilets. And just bullying as well, you know, almost 50% of the staff who took part in this survey and the investigation, I should say, they said they had been subject to bullying or had witnessed bullying. So that was a really disturbing outcome. And there were also issues to do with racism. So a large proportion of people reported sort of either seeing or being subject to racism, and it got particularly bad if you're someone who is an Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander employee for Rio Tinto. For men, it was up to almost 40% of respondents who said they'd experienced racism, and for women, it was about that as well, about 31%.
Yeah, wow. And what about younger women in particular? Did this research kind of single younger women out?
Yeah, sadly, younger people were far more likely to be subject to sexual harassment. If you were under 25, about 35% of the women said they had experienced sexual harassment, and women 25 to 34, it was about 40%. So, yeah, huge numbers there.
The report talked about a culture of silence, and that is something that we hear a lot about in workplaces where there's widespread harassment and abuse. Is that because the people who were experiencing this felt that they couldn't go to their bosses, that their bosses wouldn't help?
Yeah, one of the things that really jumped out at me when reading this report was the talk about the kind of male-dominated hierarchy within the company and the idea that women just didn't think they would be believed. And it's something we've heard so many times, you know, in all kinds of contexts. So, yeah, very few people actually did report. Less than 5% of the women reported sexual harassment, and then only 2% of men were the same. You know, people talked about being afraid of having negative impacts on their career. And they thought, yeah, management wouldn't take their concerns seriously.
What was behind it? How did all of this start? Like, why did Rio Tinto decide to launch this probe?
Well, I'm over here in Western Australia, which is really a mining state. And in the last year, we've been seeing increasing and, you know, distressing reports of women reporting being raped or assaulted on mine sites, particularly FIFO sites. It's there was a real disproportionate number of women who were sort of reporting that kind of behaviour on those fly-in, fly-out sites. So that's been the climate over here. We've had a parliamentary inquiry here looking into the issue, and we got some really disturbing findings out of that as well. The WA police said that they'd investigated 26 allegations of sexual assault and sexual harassment on mine sites in the past 2 years. So I think Rio is coming into that kind of climate and wanted to take a good hard look at themselves and you know, the safety of their employees, given this is such an emerging issue, an issue that's finally, I guess, getting some attention in the mining industry.
These findings are obviously really concerning. What about recommendations? Were there recommendations at the end of all this, and has Rio Tinto agreed to them?
Yeah, Rio Tinto, again, I mean, it's important to remember that Rio actually commissioned this report and then they released it publicly in full. So what they're doing is trying, I think, to make a statement to say that we acknowledge, and this is what they've said, we acknowledge that these issues exist, and they've pledged to adopt all of the recommendations in the report. So there were 26 recommendations put through. They sort of, broadly speaking, covered things like we were talking about earlier, like, you know, ensuring that people are a commitment to make sure that people are taken seriously, a commitment for the company's leadership to sort of create a safe and respectful and inclusive workspace, and, you know, preventing those kind of harmful behaviours. They've also pledged to increase diversity in the company, which, as we know from the figures coming out yesterday, 79% of all employees at Rio Tinto are actually male. So perhaps, you know, seeking to correct that gender imbalance. They also have said they're going to try and make it safe for people to call out those unacceptable behaviours. So, yeah, and make it easy for them to highlight issues and then receive support.
ABC reporter Rebecca Trigger, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Hack. On Triple J.
On the text line, someone says, I worked in the mining industry when I was 19 and left because of the treatment of my male workers, even though I loved my job. I've returned back to the industry in my 40s to see some improvements, but still face inequalities.
Hack.
I have a condition called synesthesia where I see styles. I see them. Everything that I sonically make is a painting.
On Triple J.
Well, imagine tasting ice cream every time you hear a puppy bark, or tasting raw onions every time you hear Dave Marchese presenting Hack. I mean, it's not ideal, but hey, it sounds strange. A lot of people live with this sensory cross-wiring. Some love it, others find it heaps overwhelming. If you're one of them, let me know. I'm keen to hear. 0439 75 7555. In the meantime, Joe Lauder's been finding out more about the world of synesthesia.
Stephanie Kabanyana Kinyandakwe still remembers the first time it happened.
I clearly remember being in Papua New Guinea, where our family was stationed at the time, and my mum was part of a local music group. And she was playing panpipes, and they were telling this story of a pig hunt. And I remember just being quite bewildered because I was there listening to the pipes that my mum was playing, but I was also seeing all of these colours and movement.
It was an intense experience.
Imagine a little three-year-old just walking into the middle of a circle and sitting down on the ground and going, the blue's spinning. And that's the best way I could describe it, you know, is this wash of sound and colour happening, and I just got really dizzy.
This is Steph's first memory of what's called synesthesia.
It just kept on happening, and slowly I realised that I see colours when I hear music, and in particular when I hear voices. So people's voices have an individual timbre and texture that relates to colour and movement.
Can you give an example? Like, what about my voice, for example?
Your voice has a lot of kind of... Imagine white fluffy clouds above your head.
Nice.
And then every now and then there's like these little kind of green vines that come down in between the white fluffy clouds.
That's amazing. That's a huge compliment. I mean, it sounds nice. Synesthesia is a neurological phenomenon where when one sense is activated, at the same time, another unrelated one also is activated. And it's not just seeing sounds like Steffa does. It's a mix of all senses. So for some people, it's letters having colours, or other people smell certain sounds. There's one guy in the UK who tastes sound, and his dog bark is custard, and his nephew is toffee.
Synesthesia is an umbrella term for essentially what's an extraordinary experience to a really ordinary stimulus.
Professor Nina Rich researches synesthesia at Macquarie University's School of Psychological Sciences.
So, for example, someone with auditory visual synesthesia might have, every time they hear a sound, it will have a visual component. It might be a colour, it might be a geometric form, and every time they hear that sound, they'll experience that colour.
And Professor Rich says it's a lot more common than you're probably thinking.
Because it's not a disorder, lots of people have synesthesia and don't realise that they have it. But the estimates vary from about 1% to possibly up to 4%.
Synesthesia isn't a disorder or a disability. It comes under the umbrella of neurodiversity. But scientists are still trying to work out why and how it occurs. One theory is that synesthetes just have brains that work in different ways to a neurotypical person. But another theory is that we're all born with this cross-wiring of the senses, and our brains learn or are taught to tune out those extra senses. More research is being done in the space, and Professor Rich says her own studies have used what's called magnetoencephalography to prove that these experiences are happening.
We were able to show that synesthetes experiencing their synesthetic colours, the representation of information about colour in the brain was similar to when they were experiencing synesthesia from stimuli that the rest of us would say weren't coloured.
For Steffa, it's almost like she goes around in the world in an augmented reality.
Mine primarily have to do with sound, and any sounds create light, colour, texture, shapes that appear in front of my eyes, almost like you're wearing a set of glasses.
Steffa is a musician and a composer, and one of her big loves is classical music. She's actually a presenter on ABC Classic. And there are some famous synesthetes out there, especially musicians, like Pharrell Williams, Frank Ocean, Mary J. Blige, Kanye, Lorde, and Billie Eilish. They've all talked about their synesthesia.
You can hear something that sounds the way that Velvet feels.
Well, it's the only way that I can identify what something sounds like. You know, I know when something is in key because it either matches the same color or it doesn't, or it feels different and it doesn't feel right.
Professor Anita Rich told me people working in creative fields are overrepresented in her surveys on synesthesia, but that could also just mean that creative synesthetes were more open to getting involved in the research. For Steffa, it's a big part of her creative process.
In general, oboes are always going to have this weird sense of fuchsia base to whatever they play because they have that particular sound. For me, I studied like clarinet and piano, so I loved the wash of the piano because that's like playing a rainbow for me. But the clarinet was always lovely because it feels like amber in my world, and that was really soothing.
And all of this sounds amazing and enviable, but Steffa says it's not always like that. It can be overwhelming, and she even wears special earplugs to tune out the world around her.
For me, it's so debilitating at times. I have to be in cold, dark rooms to take the set of senses away from me, almost like a sensory deprivation chamber, to calm my body down.
But overall, she calls it her superpower, and she wishes we could all see what's going on.
I think that would be absolutely amazing, particularly if you could share the experiences of others. I think that's what I often come home to is saying, you know, can't wait until like my eyes become data projectors and you can just plug into the back of my head and the USB port and just see what's going on. Wouldn't that be great?
Hack Triple J.
Joe Lauder with that story, or should I say green vine, white fluffy cloud lady, such a good description. And if you think that you might have synesthesia, you can look up Macquarie Uni's Synesthesia Research Group. They can help you out there. A lot of you on the text line saying you've got it. Alex from the Yarra Valley, my partner and I both have synesthesia, so it's super coincidental. And another person, I have synesthesia. Every time I hear Scott Morrison talk, I taste pork pies.
Hack. Afghan women are accusing the Taliban of using a pregnant Kiwi journalist's plight to return home as a publicity stunt to get international support.
On Triple J.
When the Taliban took control of Afghanistan last year, girls and women in the country had their rights stripped away. How they behave, what they wear, even when they can leave their house, is all now strictly controlled. So it was pretty surprising earlier this week when a Kiwi journalist came out saying that she was rejected from returning home to New Zealand because of its strict COVID rules, but was offered support by the Taliban instead. Afghan women are now accusing the Taliban of using the pregnant journo as a publicity stunt to get international support. The ABC's New South Asia correspondent and the former host of Hack, Avani Dias, has been covering the story.
Charlotte Bellis is a Kiwi journalist, and a few days ago she wrote this column that went off around the world. She said the Taliban offered her, an unmarried pregnant woman, safe haven because the New Zealand government would not let her go back home. She'd gotten pregnant while living in Qatar, but it's illegal to be pregnant and unmarried there. And then she was rejected from New Zealand's hotel quarantine. So she went to Afghanistan because she has a visa for that country. She called it a brutal irony that the Taliban took her in and the New Zealand government did not. But as people all around the world were reading that column, Afghan women were protesting the disappearance of female activists.
So actually they were surprised, wow, Taliban can behave and treat a woman in a good manner.
That's 30-year-old Sodaba, who is based in Kabul, and she says this whole thing has highlighted the difference in how the militant Taliban treats foreign women like Charlotte Bellis compared to Afghan women. She says it's a massive publicity stunt for this group.
Taliban trying to convey the message that they are know about human rights, especially women rights. But in reality, their treatment is not good enough with Afghan women, as they are supporting and respect for that New Zealand lady.
It's been an international embarrassment for the New Zealand government. So on Tuesday, the New Zealand deputy PM backflipped and offered Charlotte a place in hotel quarantine so she can leave Afghanistan. But she said she wasn't given permission to go home because she's pregnant, but because of the security risks of staying there.
There is a place in MIQ for the type of situation that Charlotte Bellis is facing. And in fact, there is a secured place for her.
As Sodaba says, the Taliban are not feminist crusaders. In September, fighters were seen shooting dead a pregnant former Afghan policewoman. The group denies it was involved, but Afghan man Dr. Omar Sather from Pittsburgh Uni says this all shows massive contradictions in how the Taliban operates. He's been researching the militant group which took over Afghanistan 6 months ago.
So this is really a double standard. Why they treat a white Western woman and a way to show the world, the international community, that they are behaving like a responsible government, or let's say like a civilized government, but with respect to the people of Afghanistan and the women in Afghanistan, they behave totally different.
Since the Taliban swooped into power in Afghanistan, women say they now live in fear, they can't study or work. And because Western countries have cut off cash from being sent into Afghanistan, large parts of the country are now dealing with extreme levels of hunger. Last week, Europe and the US said to the Taliban, "We will give you humanitarian aid if you improve human rights back home." Sodaba doesn't want the international community to offer support to the Taliban until all women in Afghanistan, not just foreigners, are given basic rights.
Do not recognize them officially until they really change their mindsets about women, until they really give the human right for Afghans.
Hack Triple J.
Avani Dias there with her first story as the ABC's South Asia correspondent. Thanks to Av, and production in that story by Joe Lauder. Well, for more on this, we're joined by Muzgan Samarkandi, an Afghan journalist who now lives in New Zealand. Muzgan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
How did you feel when you read Charlotte Bellis's column saying that the Taliban had offered her safe haven?
I feel really upset because I was really disappointed on her and with Charlotte, because she was in Afghanistan and she was on that situation, on that position, that she could be the voice of the woman in Afghanistan, that they can't raise their voice. At least she could deliver the message for the world that what is going on in Afghanistan, what's happening to the women in Afghanistan, what's happening with our activists. They're going missing, and they were protesting for their basic rights, which was education and work. But Taliban is not accepting that. And Charlotte used that one as her background to make her point and to provoke the New Zealand government to give her MIQ room. And that was really upsetting for me.
Well, you've written your own open letter to Charlotte Bellis saying that she's trivializing the Taliban. Why do you think that?
Because she was comparing the Taliban with the New Zealand government, which is not fair, which is really not fair. Right now, what is happening in Afghanistan, what is going on there, and it's not fair to compare with New Zealand government. And Taliban, they don't have any value. They don't have any good value. They are wild, and they are not respecting for human beings, especially for women. They are not treating us that we are even existing. They are treating us that we are nothing. We can't go out of the house even by ourselves because there should be a man with us, a mahram, and they are not letting us to do anything. And Shalad was comparing that with New Zealand government, which was really upsetting.
Wuzgan, it has been months since we saw foreign forces leave Afghanistan. What is the reality for women and girls in Afghanistan right now?
The reality is really bad. What Charlotte is showing is not the reality. Yeah, of course, for someone being foreigner, it is safe, but it is not safe. The woman that I mentioned, they were protesting for their basic rights. And like Parwana, like Tamana, and also her sisters, they're going missing for 2 weeks, and we don't know about them. What is happening? And also the young girls from my village that I know, by forcing the Taliban is marrying with them, and she was the first year of law last year, and now she's a housewife for a Talib. And no one is doing anything for us. And it seems the world already forgotten about us.
And do you think this is part of the Taliban's strategy to appear more open and accepting to people overseas than they actually are in reality in Afghanistan?
Of course, they're using that. That's why they gave Charlotte's safe place there, because they want the world to see like how we are good people. They're actually worse than before. They just learn how to show their other face to the world, that we are not what the Afghan women or the Afghanistani women are saying about us. What they are doing, that's not the truth. See, there is unmarried woman, which is from other country, and she is pregnant, and we are giving her a space to live here. It sounds that we are lying. It sounds that what we are doing is not true.
And do you think the situation in Afghanistan is getting enough coverage in countries like Australia and New Zealand when you're looking at the media? Do you think we're at risk of forgetting about what's happening there to girls and women?
Yeah, not at all. I am disappointed. I was expecting more from New Zealand, and especially New Zealand and Australia, to cover more after they took their people from Afghanistan and they left the country and they forgot about it. They forgot what is happening in that country. And they're not covering anything. Taliban is coming in the middle of the night, suspecting people who is against of their government, who is not listening to them. They're killing them. It's happening for months and months. And no one discovered that. No one said that to the social media, to the media, to the world. What is happening in this country? How many people did? How many women did? How many people are going missing? How many young girls become Taliban's second and third wives?
Hack on Triple J.
Afghan writer Muzgan Samarkandi there. And that's all we have time for on the Hack podcast for now. I'll catch you next time.